Hallo, hier ist Clark. Sicher gibt es Dinge, bei denen du dich trotz einer riesen Auswahl super auskennst. Vielleicht sind es Automodelle oder Joghurtalternativen. Und wie sieht es mit Versicherungen aus? Kein Problem. Mit Clark hast du auch da den Plan. Denn Clark vergleicht die Angebote von über 160 Versicherern für dich und empfiehlt dir die, die zu dir passen. Die Übersicht über alle deine Versicherungsverträge behältst du mit der kostenlosen Clark-App. Ganz ohne Papierkram.
Baby, I'll give it to you.
That looks really good.
Yes, it does. It's dead on.
Okay, keep the chatter down in this room.
Are you ready to begin?
Yes, I'm all set, sir.
Hello, welcome to Space Boffins, proudly stretching the definition of monthly podcast since 2011. We're in partnership with the Naked Scientists, and I'm Richard Hollingham.
And I'm Sue Nelson, and we promise it's worth the wait. After William Shatner contemplates the view of Earth from space, we'll be discussing the importance of space technology to solve problems on our own planet. We'll also speak to Apollo legend and NASA employee of 55 years, Jerry Woodfill.
Actually, you're talking to Snoopy's veterinarian right here. Because if Snoopy got sick, you know, the lunar lander, I'm the guy that's monitoring Snoopy's functions because I'm the alarm. I'm not Snoopy's veterinarian. And then if Charlie Brown, the command doesn't work, I'm the doctor.
Snoopy is a spacecraft.
Yes, I gathered that. He sounds very excitable. I'm looking forward to hearing that
conversation. He is fantastic. Jerry is fantastic.
Now, you may have seen in the news recently that the Bepi Colombo spacecraft had arrived at Mercury, which was a slightly premature phrasing by some media, as the joint ESA and JAXA mission to Mercury was actually a flyby. This is the mission that launched in 2018 and actually is made up of three spacecraft. I know we featured it on this podcast before, but those three spacecraft are a European transfer module and Mercury planetary orbiter and the Japanese Mercury magnetospheric orbiter. That's quite I find that quite hard to say. Anyway, Dr. Charlie Feldman from the University of Leicester works on the optics of the European orbiter, which, as we'll hear, are based on lobster eyes. Yes, I actually said lobster eyes. And they're being used in an increasing number of new missions. But she began by explaining why Bepi Colombo's journey to Mercury is far from over.
We've got more of the journey to go than we've already done, in a way, because it's another 4 and a bit years before we actually go into orbit, whereas we launched 3 years ago, so still got a long way to go.
So why does it have to do a flyby of its destination in order to get to its destination?
Because of the massive ball of gas, which has a huge gravity that's not that far away. If you don't decelerate, you're going to crash into the sun and then all your work is pointless. So yes, you have to use Mercury flybys to slow yourself down to be able to get into the orbit of Mercury. And in order to make sure that you do that in a controlled way, the best way to do it is to do multiple flybys. We have no brakes, so you can't just slam on the brakes and stop. You have to slowly release energy, and the best way to do that is by slowly orbiting around Mercury. The orbits slowly get closer and closer and closer until finally you're in orbit around Mercury.
That's amazing, really. I must admit, the orbital mechanics of a lot of these missions is a sort of a symphony in itself, isn't it, before you even get to the science in terms of what's going to happen when you get there.
Yes, definitely. And that's why the mission is called Bepi Colombo, because it's named after Giuseppe Colombo, who came up with how to get to Mercury and the best way to do it.
Yes, it's a wonderful tribute, isn't it? Your expertise is in the optics. Tell us about which instrument you're actually involved in.
That would be the Mercury Imaging X-ray Spectrometer, which we shorten to MIX because it's a lot easier to say. And it's actually two instruments in one. We've got a telescope and a collimator, which sit side by side to each other. And they're on board the European Space Agency spacecraft, because Bepi Colombo is actually three spacecraft joined together, one which is the propulsion module, one which is the Japanese Space Agency's spacecraft, and then there's the European Space Agency spacecraft. And the MIX instrument is going to try and use X-ray fluorescence of the Mercurian surface in order to be able to work out exactly what Mercury is made of, because actually we don't know exactly what materials are on the surface of Mercury.
That's quite extraordinary, really, isn't it, considering it's one of, you know, it's a fairly close planet.
Yeah, there's very little that we know about it. I mean, MESSENGER, which was a NASA mission a few years ago, yeah, that gave us a lot of insight and, as always, asked more questions than it actually answered.
So where does this fluorescence come from?
It's the interaction of the solar wind with the Mercurian surface, because Mercury doesn't have an atmosphere, unlike us. You don't get the diversion of it around the planet. It fully bombards the planet, and the high energy electrons excite the surface, and then each material gives off a specific signature, which we can then see with our instrument.
So you can then tell what element it is based on the type of fluorescence you get.
Exactly, but with this instrument is slightly different because we're actually imaging it as well. So instead of just getting the signal to say over there was a bit of iron, we'll actually be able to see the crater and see where each element is within that crater. So it's a very exciting instrument because it's the first time we're actually doing X-ray imaging of a planet.
That is pretty special, isn't it? Because you're then going to get a really detailed mineral map, effectively. Then
that is the hope. Yes. Yes, as long as everything works, which is always the hope.
But, I'm sure it will. Now, what made you turn to a crustacean as inspiration for your optics?
It wasn't me personally. It actually happened before I was born. There was a lot of studies in the 1970s on crustaceans' eyes. I'm not really sure why. But there was this discovery that actually they don't have lenses for eyes. They have a series of very, very regular square pores, which are arranged over a sphere. So you end up with all of the pores pointing towards the retina and the centre of the retina. And the image is created on the lobster's retina by the reflections of the light on the very smooth surfaces of these pores. And a very intelligent man called Angel published a paper in 1979 where he proposed that actually this is very similar to the concept that we use for focusing X-rays. X-ray astronomy was still quite new at that point, and we were using traditional what are called Volta optics, which are thin ceramic or metal shells. They look a bit like dustbins, really, and they're completely nested inside each other, a bit like a Russian doll, so you get smaller and smaller and smaller ones as you get towards the centre. And we're using very shallow angles, and he just said, hang on, that's exactly what the lobsters and crustaceans' eyes are doing. Could we find a way of reproducing this and creating wide field of view X-ray optics? Because if you look at the traditional X-ray optics, they have a very, very narrow field of view, you know, normally limited. I saw one which said that it had a field of view of one arc minute, whereas we talk in degrees when we talk about lobster eye optics. So you could create huge field of view optic by adopting the lobster eyes as a biomimicking.
I've seen a lobster eye in close-up, but only because I attended one of your talks recently at the National Space Museum in Leicester. And it was quite astonishing, because when you think of a sort of cartoon depiction of a lobster, you know, the traditional claws, that sort of orangey-red colour if it's been cooked, and then those sort of big black, slightly bulbous, globular eyes. And it was only when you showed one in close-up that everybody sort of went, because it was like a collection of tiny squares.
Yeah, I was very pleased when I found that picture, actually, because normally we say, look, here's a lobster, and then we show the electron microscope image. And although you can see all the squares in the microscope image, it's a little bit abstract because you've gone from, as you say, this orange thing And then all of a sudden you're being told there's squares there. And I really liked that picture that I found, which really shows there's the big black ball, but you can actually see all the little squares on top of it.
And just give us an idea, on a lobster, how big are those squares? And on your instrument, how big are those squares that you're recreating?
I'm going to have to admit, I don't actually know how big a lobster's eyeballs are.
If you're using electron microscope, then we're assuming...
Yeah, that they must be on a similar scale. I think they're larger than ours. They're probably more around the sort of 100 micron level, whereas ours tend to be the 40 or 20 microns, so smaller than a human hair.
Yeah. So you've recreated that system on your instrument. What size are the squares? You call them cells, is that right?
Each individual micropore optic, or MPO, is about 4 centimetres by 4 centimetres square. And then inside that are the array of very, very regular square pores, which are about 40 microns or 20 microns in width.
I find optics pores are funny, a hard word to get your head around, because I think pores as the circular pinpricks on your skin, whereas you're talking pores as squares.
And actually, we still talk about pore diameters. Originally, the optics were used as photon multipliers, and then they were developed to be X-ray detectors. And in both cases, they had circular pores. And then when Angel's paper came out, development started to be made to have square pores, square cross-section pores. But the names have stuck. We don't talk about the width of a pore. We talk about the diameter of a pore, because it's still from when they were circular.
Has this design ever been used before on a space instrument?
There have been instruments on sounding rockets, and there was one that actually went onto the International Space Station, but they were single optics, whereas we're now putting, 25, some missions are talking about having 100 individual optics on top of the instrument. So we are really upscaling how many optics are flying. But yes, this is the very first space mission with an instrument of this size.
So give us an idea then of the size of your optic.
Each individual optic is about 4 centimetres by 4 centimetres, but then we tessellate them or put them into an array to create the full size of the telescope. So in the case of Bepi Colombo, the collimator has an array of 2 by 2, so a total of 4 of these optics. And then in the telescope, we've used a slightly different arrangement so that we have a circular optic. And in that arrangement, we've got 72 optics, but they're in 2 layers. So you only see the front layer of 36 individual optics.
You've obviously got a bit of a waiting game now to go until you actually get into orbit around Mercury and your optics can start doing their work. But obviously, in terms of what you're going to do, I mean, this, as you said, this is really exciting in terms of what you're able to detect on the surface of Mercury. Have other missions seen the potential here and thought, yes, we'll have some of those lobster optics?
Well, lobster optics are really, really versatile. We're actually working on several other missions, one of which is going to do Earth observational science and looking at the magnetosphere and the solar wind interaction. And that mission is called SMILE. But I'm also working on other missions which are looking at exploding stars and gamma ray bursts and transient events. So stars with huge variability, but also the early population of stars. So they're really is a huge variety of things that you can do. If there's X-rays, we can detect them.
Charlie Feldman from the University of Leicester.
Still to come on Space Boffins, and I can't trail this enough, the Apollo engineer inspired by President Kennedy and still working at NASA. Now, I have always argued that we need to send artists, musicians and even politicians into space.
I'm jealous.
And journalists. Yeah. I haven't argued that,
no,
but
I can argue that.
Okay. And William Shatner's flight with Blue Origin proves why.
this comforter of blue that we have around us. We think, oh, that's blue sky. And then suddenly you shoot through it all of a sudden, as though you whip off a sheet off you when you're asleep, and you're looking into blackness, into black ugliness. And you look down, and there's the blue down there, and the black up there, and it's just, there is mother and earth and comfort, and is there death? I don't know. Is that death? Is that the way death is? Whoop, and it's gone. Jesus.
I love that. I love that. I described it on Twitter as him going all Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds, and it did remind me of his sort of delivery there of something
thoughtful.
Kaleidoscopic.
It's thoughtful.
It was brilliant.
It's so irritating, that clip. You can hear it in the background there with the idiot billionaires with their champagne in the background.
Yeah,
you just want to hear William Shatner.
Well, at one point, Bezos did effectively interrupt his flow by basically asking him, do you want to waste some champagne. I mean, who would waste champagne anyway? I wouldn't.
If you're a billionaire.
And I think he then realised, because Shatner just wasn't interested and just said no thank you and was just standing there stunned. And yeah, that for me was an amazing moment of articulate wonder and awe in terms of, and a reminder to people that this means something, not just on a technological, scientific, adventure, exploration scale, but actually in terms of philosophical meaning and what it is to be human and to look beyond the earth. So, yeah, good on you, Bill.
Well, I do think, and this was why I was, arguing this before, is that it takes someone more than an astronaut to articulate this. This is why you need actors and journalists and writers
to actually suppress the emotion so that even if, say, the craft was crashing, they would say something like, engines non-nominal or something like,
there are good reasons you need that.
Very
good reasons. You don't want to send up, your average rock star.
It's the same reason why sometimes space scientists, they've forgotten that what they're doing is actually pretty cool. But because they might have been interviewed so many times or talked about it so many times, they can lose that sense of awe and wonder. I mean, it doesn't always work because I don't think you can assume that all actors, let alone 90-year-old actors, will be as articulate as that.
Let's see what Tom Cruise is like when he comes back from space.
Oh, he'll just jump up and down, if that's it, get overexcited physically. That sounds rude, doesn't it? But I don't mean it that way. Yes, because I think there are actors who wouldn't be able to do that. Because I do remember years ago, when we were both down in Cornwall, 1999, for the Cornwall eclipse. It was one of the first one in decades to be seen in the UK.
Or not,
exactly. It was cloudy, which was really annoying because we knew it would be cloudy and had wanted to be elsewhere. And where we'd wanted to be was on an island in the Channel Islands, which the Royal Astronomical Society had gone to. But I was working for the BBC. We were both working for the BBC at the time. So we had no choice and they didn't take our advice, which is why we saw clouds. And the only person, the only BBC reporter who was on that island was actually a children's presenter. And this guy was so overawed by it that I saw that basically the commentary for that period was, So even a presenter can't always articulate as well as William Shatner.
Anyway. After William Shatner's flight, there's been the predictable fuss about billionaires wasting money on space when they should be spending it solving problems on Earth, such as climate change. But of course, as we know, we can do both. And frankly, without space and the satellites that monitor the Earth, we wouldn't know much about what's going on anyway. Well, ahead of the COP26 climate change talks in Glasgow, I've been talking about the importance of space when it comes to climate change with Liz Cox. She's head of international engagement for the UK Space Agency.
Climate change is affecting us all in different ways. In the UK, we've had these terrible flooding events, and then obviously last year as well, or earlier this year in Germany. But then all around the world as well, you know, there's deforestation happening, cyclones happening on Pacific islands. It's happening in so many different ways. And the crucial thing is that satellites orbiting the Earth help us understand and track and make really informed decisions about climate change. They're our eyes in the sky, and they can provide imagery and data that can really help to track and make decisions about climate change.
I suppose space gives us a unique perspective, doesn't it? And it's easy to forget that, because you can see things from an aircraft. You could fly over the Amazon and see deforestation, but from space you can see, for example, the whole Amazon.
Absolutely. In the programme that I work on, for example, the International Partnership Programme, which is our Space for Sustainable Development initiative, the thing that I always talk about is the additionality of space with other data, so ground and airborne data. So it's those layers of information that can really provide that complete and hugely valuable picture.
Now, you mentioned the International Partnership Programme. Just give us an overview of what that is without getting too corporate and too government about it.
I can give you quite a passionate idea of what IPP, the International Partnership Programme, is about, because this is the thing that I spend all my time on. It's just an excellent programme. The whole premise of IPP is about developing really innovative space-based solutions that can help countries and communities adapt to climate change and then other development challenges. So it is things like health, deforestation, reducing maritime problems, renewable energy, urban planning. One of these is a really exciting project. It's called DEMOS, and this is a dengue fever forecasting system.
My name is Gina Tsaruhi, and I am the DEMOS project manager. Dengue is the fastest spreading mosquito-borne disease in the world today, and in particular countries in Southeast Asia have suffered some major outbreaks of dengue fever in recent years. So the main objective of this DEMOS system is to generate a system that gives health officials several months advance warning of likely outbreaks of dengue fever. Because mosquito survival and biting behavior is affected by environmental conditions, we can use Earth observation data and weather forecasts to predict changes in dengue risk up to 6 months in advance.
So what sort of difference can this make? I mean, ultimately, this is about saving people from serious illness or death even.
That's correct. I think the key difference that the system has made in Vietnam is that it has changed the Vietnamese government's approach to dengue. So from a reactive approach, they have moved into a proactive one. So now they can proactively take actions on the ground to start, for example, spraying chemicals for eliminating the mosquito breeding grounds.
There are some great benefits to all of the activities that are going on in space in one way or another, but it's the impact of space on the ground that I think is really important for everybody to remember and be aware of. And this ongoing investment in space is crucial to all of us.
Liz Cox from the UK Space Agency and Gina Saochi from the DEMOS project.
This is the Space Boffins podcast. We're in partnership with the Naked Scientists. You can get in touch with us via all the usual social media channels or email us info@boffinmedia.co.uk or podcast@spaceboffins.com. We'd love to hear your comments, suggestions, questions, or just fun pictures you've had, really. Actually, that one I posted about our dinner in the spacecraft went down really well, didn't it?
Well, I was wondering whether there's a crossover here between a space podcast and
food.
A foodie podcast. I was wondering whether we should rebrand and get some free food.
That's, yeah. Yeah, I'd be happy to do that. And if
one drink.
Yes. Oh, obviously. And if you haven't seen that photo. Basically, it's in a Gordon Ramsay restaurant in East London.
It sounds posher than it was.
Yeah, it's not. It's just mostly brown food. But the spacecraft inexplicably really seems to have just been built for this restaurant as a sort of oddity, because it's not a space themed restaurant in any way, shape or form, and the staff are brilliantly friendly and fun. But you know, they arrive and I didn't correct them with this word, but I did want to. They said, oh yes, would you like to come to the spaceship? And as we were walking over, I was muttering to Richard, it's a spacecraft, it's not a spaceship, it's a spacecraft, not a But you have to have a set meal, and it was just brilliant because it looked like a nice silver but shiny Apollo cell capsule with so many courses we could barely walk afterwards because we were so full. But wasn't it fun?
It was fun. See, look, there's loads of potential here of space-themed
Absolutely. Space-themed food. I think, you know, if I was going to change careers, that would be really fun to do, wouldn't it? It's just have everything space themed on the walls, spacecraft that people could eat in, because you could have sat, because it was like a curved sort of bench, wasn't it? So it was just us two, but you could have had four people in there easily. So yeah, you could have different, and you could have different style space. Oh, I'm getting quite excited about this now.
So you've gone away from podcast. you're creating a whole new business on a space themed restaurant.
Thinking, if you had like a shuttle, a mock-up of a shuttle. Admittedly, you're obviously wasting quite a lot of space with the wings, but maybe you could have people having a table on the wings. But you could have a group, a private group, on a long table inside a small mock-up.
Oh, I see, in the bay.
Yeah, okay. And then you've got the little Apollo capsules for a more intimate. Maybe you could have a Mercury capsule for a, you know, dinner for two.
No, dinner for one on Mercury.
Actually, that's true, yes. I was trying to be sociable, yes.
That's Gemini, yeah.
Yeah, I like that.
Well, I'm sure someone will mention, but John Young famously brought corned beef on board a Gemini capsule, and that was a mistake.
Why?
Well, corned beef's a really dry food. And they spent the rest of the mission picking out corned beef from the instrument panel.
All right. Well, I'll have to think of a menu. If anybody's got idea of food that would, maybe we'll put that. I'll put that on Twitter and Facebook. Is some suggestions for food suitable to space food.
Themed. Where we, space themed. You're suggesting. Hang on. You're suggesting we should open a space themed restaurant.
No. In my head. Yes.
See, I have been. The best bar I went to, which wasn't space themed, but was train themed. And you've seen pictures of this. This was in Moscow.
Oh yeah.
Sadly, I've told it's closed now. But you basically, someone came around to take your order, and the beers or food, they could fit pizzas, were delivered by train.
Ah, so
for these model trains.
Ah, but we could do that.
See, I'm wondering whether you could do something similar with Rocket.
Oh! With a crawler. But that would be a really long wait.
About 5 hour wait.
You'd have to, pre-book your drinks. But you could, couldn't you? You could have a little rocket crawler that comes out.
Yeah.
Oh, yes. Oh, I think we've got something there. Yeah.
Surefire business.
Yes. Great. Yeah, please send us some food. What would be on your menu?
Now, if you're still listening, a few years ago, I was at NASA in Houston making a radio program, and I met Apollo engineer Jerry Woodfill. And we sat on a bench in front of the giant Saturn V rocket, and he just talked. And I struggled to get a word in edgeways, but it was fascinating. And I've been wanting to interview him again for a long time. So we've done that. He was responsible for the Apollo alarm system, crucial during the Apollo 13 mission. What's remarkable is that 55 years after joining NASA, he still works there. Now, we're going to talk to Jerry about Apollo 13 in a future podcast. But in this first new interview, we discuss his inspiration for joining the space program, the Apollo 1 fire, which killed three astronauts, and the near disaster in Apollo 10. Now, unfortunately, the combined efforts of a NASA engineer and ex-BBC producer weren't enough to successfully extract audio from Jerry's phone, so the quality of the recording isn't as good as I would have liked. The interview also features a brief astronaut profanity and begins with another disclaimer.
So if some things that I share are a little bit, you know, incorrect, cut me some slack. It's because it's over 50 years ago, all right?
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things. not because they are easy, but because they are hard. Because that goal will serve to organize and measure the best of our energies and skills.
I've spoken to you a couple of times. I remember when I first spoke to you, the fact that you're still working at NASA is extraordinary to me. But you were there at Rice University when Kennedy gave that famous speech. That was your inspiration. I mean, you're like the poster child for NASA.
I like that word, poster child. That's good. I'm going to be 79 years old next week. Okay, so I like being called a poster child. Wonderful. Yeah, I was about 21 years old. And I was in Rice Stadium and listening to the president as he shared that momentous talk. In fact, if you go look back on history, the greatest speeches of all time, well, that's always listed as one of them, the one he gave at Rice Stadium. So I was there and I heard it. And for me, it was significant because I was a struggling engineering student. In fact, I think I had the lowest grade ever made at Rice in differential equations. It didn't look like I was going to go anywhere. But when President Kennedy came and he said, we do this thing not because it's easy, but because it's hard. When I heard him say that, I thought, my studies were hard. I was not doing well. But if we could go to the moon, certainly I could just focus and graduate. And so what I did, I was on a basketball scholarship, Richard. I wasn't doing well on that either. I had the lowest shooting percentage of anybody that ever played basketball for the Rice Owls. And so I gave up my basketball scholarship and I graduated. And so NASA at that time was involved in the Gemini program. And so most of the engineers were focusing on Gemini, you know, the two-man vehicle that would test out all the procedures that you need to actually prove to go to the moon. And so because of that, when NASA hired me, I was, I guess, one of the first guys that came into my division. And they assigned me instrumentation group, measurements and instrumentation group. And really, that was basically switches and gauges. And I was very disappointed. I said, I took all these courses and solving the quantum equation and all these kinds of things. And they assigned me switches and gauges of all things. But they also needed a guy to look over the alarm system for the mothership. That's the command module. That's the three-man vehicle that with the lunar lander goes out to the moon and it orbits the moon and then the lander goes down to the moon. And so I was given the alarm system for the actual mothership. They said, well, he's our electrical engineer and we need a guy and he's our man. And so they never asked me about my F minus or anything like that. They said he's got a degree, a BS degree in electrical engineering. So that's what I became. And so in that capacity, I began to meet many of the Apollo astronauts because they wanted to know what this guy that's actually responsible for their lives, basically. And I always think back to that day at Rice Stadium. And then when John Kennedy gave that speech to Congress, he said, we're going to send a man to the moon and then return him safely to the earth. Well, I was the guy that was directly responsible for returning him safely to the earth. Because if I didn't do a good job, that was going to really affect the situation on returning him safe to the earth.
You were involved in pretty much the whole Apollo program because when you joined, Gemini was ongoing. Yeah. You saw firsthand the problems with Apollo 1 that led to the tragedy and the loss of life of the three astronauts.
That's for sure. In fact, that's one of the main things I always share about my career is I came on so early. They were just actually testing out the boost system, you know, the Saturn V and how the command ship and all those things would work together as the boost system and so forth. And so I was responsible for the alarm system on Apollo 1 as well. And I had already gone out to the manufacturer of Apollo 1. They called it Spacecraft 12. That was the designation for that command ship that was going to take our first crew to test it out in orbit. So I went out to the manufacturer, North American Rockwell, and when I got there and they checked me in through the secretary and they gave me my badge, there was another gentleman checking in as well at the same time, and it was Roger Chaffee. So that's where I met Roger Chaffee, and he and I that week, it was the final test and signing off and saying that a spacecraft 12 of Apollo 1 was ready to go to the Cape and then be launched in January. And so during that week, I met Roger, and he and I talked about the alarm system and so forth. And then we had the final review with all these NASA headquarters of people and everyone. And I had to present the alarm system to tell them that I thought it was a good system and it would work. Well, they got to Cape Kennedy, and Roger and Ed White and Gus were in the capsule January 27th of 1967, I guess it was. Roger would have been on the right. Ed White was in the center. And then Gus Grissom was on the left side. Well, the fire was a short circuit under Gus's couch. It had to do with the wiring of the environmental control system that was under Gus's couch. And so when it started, terrible design. We had all kinds of Velcro and flammable materials and didn't even have a fire extinguisher on board. And the oxygen pressure was more than atmospheric pressure. And besides that, it was pure oxygen. It's just a horrible, horrible design to save people's lives. It's horrible.
Some places you could see right down to the clear, I presume, copper. The wires were ragged. Ragged meaning the insulation was ragged where the fire had, you know, eaten away more in one place, less than another.
Okay, so what happened? Of course, they perished, and I was the alarm system engineer. So in that capacity, they wanted me to look at the entire alarm system to see how we actually protected astronauts, and we needed to look at that and redesign it so that the future crews would never perish. And because of that, George Lowe, the head of the Apollo program, assigned a group of us, and we went to the manufacturer of the lunar lander as well as the command module, and we looked at every single alarm and came up with solutions so that that kind of a thing would never happen again. And would we have not corrected the alarm system and the situation, Apollo 13 astronauts would have perished because they were in orbit without heating and so forth in the command ship. And what had happened, their breath had caught water vapor all throughout the cabin during their return to Earth. And so when they powered up the command ship to enter, what happened is all that water vapor in their breath precipitated out, and it caused almost droplets of water behind the panel around the switch contacts. But because of Apollo 1, we had coated all of those contacts with sort of a goop, it's kind of silly putty, to make sure we never had a short circuit like had taken the lives of Apollo 1 crew. So actually, Apollo 1's astronaut saved the lives of Apollo 13's crew. So that's a story I don't think a lot of people know.
That is fascinating. I'd never heard that before. I want to come to actually Apollo 10.
Nine. We have ignition sequence start. Engines on. 5, 4, 3, 2. All engines running. Launch commit. Liftoff. We have liftoff 49 minutes past the hour.
There was a point during that mission where it almost came close to failure. I mean, serious failure and loss of life, and the first American crew to lose their lives in space.
That is a very interesting observation and request for my analysis of that situation, because recently NASA asked me to do a program with a community college library out in East New Mexico. They asked me to do a talk about Snoopy. You remember Snoopy. Apollo 10, they named the lunar lander on Apollo 10 Snoopy, and then the command module, Charlie Brown. So because of that, I said, I'm going to go back and revisit Apollo 10 and find out about Snoopy and Charlie Brown. You know, actually, you're talking to Snoopy's veterinarian right here. Because if Snoopy got sick, you know, the lunar lander, I'm the guy that's monitoring Snoopy's functions because I'm the alarm. I'm not Snoopy's veterinarian. And then if Charlie Brown, the command doesn't work, I'm the doctor for Charlie Brown. You see, I've got it all. You know, I've got all my alarm system is monitoring Charlie Brown's pulse and his breathing and every other thing that assures that he's safe and well, and he's going to make it back to Earth. And they say that Apollo 10 is always the dress rehearsal, you know. And so really, it was not full dress. Charlie Brown was okay, but Snoopy didn't have enough fuel had he landed to get off the moon. And many have said, well, they did that on purpose so they make sure that Gene Cernan and General Stafford didn't actually go down there and upstage us, Aldrin and Armstrong. You know, that was always the tale told. But really, the reason that there wasn't enough fuel is that you really didn't need to put the fuel in there. It wasn't for some sinister reason to make sure that Stafford and Gene Cernan didn't just land.
Well, Houston, Houston, this is Snoopy.
Right, Snoop, go ahead.
It's going. We is down among them, Charlie.
Roger, I hear you weaving your way up the freeway. Can you give me a post-burn report? Over.
Okay. Now, Snoopy, he is operated standing up. They had put seats in Snoopy to start with, the lunar lander. And my neighbor down the street told me that he went to the manufacturer, Grumman, one time, name is George Franklin. He said, why are you putting seats in there? It's only 6 gravity. And why just weight it down with seats? And besides that, seats, you have to sit far from the window. And it's good that they took the seats out because on Apollo 11, because Neil Armstrong could be close to the actual viewing window, he could actually see that Trancoti base and the border field. So my friend down the street took those seats out. Maybe he saved Apollo 11's crew. So anyway, they stood up on either side, 2 windows, and the control panel, many of the controls are duplicated on the pilot and the commander's side. But between them is a switch. And the switch says you can choose the primary guidance system or the abort guidance system. Well, for Apollo 10, once they had actually orbited the moon, they're getting ready to return to John Young in the command module. They were going to return using the abort guidance system to test it out. Okay, so during all the simulations, you know, they over and over and over again, they go through this procedure. Well, during the simulation, the way that it should have gone is that Stafford should have selected the abort guidance system. You can either abort guidance system or primary guidance system, one or the other. So for some reason, Gene Cernan decided to flip that switch to abort guidance before Stafford did. Now, in the simulation, Stafford always flipped that switch. So Stafford just reaches over to flip the switch.
Okay, you ready?
And the software got all confused.
I'm a bitch.
Because of that miss-switching situation.
You get in a gimbal lock?
And, of course, all at once, the vehicle was kind of actually not knowing where it was, and thrusters were firing. To Tom Stafford's credit, he was actually to take hold of the control stick and bring it back into a nominal position.
Yep, booze up, babe.
And so that they could actually put it on the abort guidance system and do a proper return to the Young in the command module.
Yeah, okay, something went wild there on that staging. And we're all set. We didn't lock it. We're going ahead to the auto maneuver.
Roger.
How close did that come to, you know, being a serious incident, or even, you know, the deaths of the crew?
Had they not corrected the situation, had they not been able to do it in sufficient time, they would have used up perhaps too much of the RCS, the actually control thrusters, propellant. Eventually, have they had not been able to correct the situation, they could actually have crashed into the moon, which, you know, that would have really set the program back if we'd ever been able to land many years. You know, in Apollo 1, it was a two-year delay, and we certainly would not have fulfilled John Kennedy's prediction that we'd be on the moon in this decade, as he had said.
And therefore, as we set sail, we ask God's blessing on the most hazardous and dangerous and greatest adventure on which man has ever embarked. Thank you.
JFK speaking at Rice Stadium in Houston, ending the first part of my interview with Jerry Woodfill. I'm going to have another chat with Jerry in the coming weeks, which I will endeavour to record in better quality, and we'll feature that in a future podcast.
The UK Space Agency very kindly supported this edition of the Space Boffins podcast. Do get in touch
podcast.
With... Podcast?
Podcast. That would be a walking-themed podcast.
Ah, there's
another spin-off from this ever-lucrative endeavour that we do.
Do get in touch with us via social media and leave a review on your podcast plodcast. I want to say podcast platform. I see on your podcast. Oh my God.
Podcast platform of choice.
Thank you. Mm. There you go.
Now, the reason this podcast is delayed is because my dad passed away a week or so back. He was a filmmaker and always encouraged my career. He taught me editing with tape and razor blades, aged 10, and also the basics of filming. So I'll dedicate this edition of Space Boffins to him, although he did never listen to the podcast. But
he's got plenty of time now. Peter, yes. Wherever you are, we know you're up there with Penny. Enjoy.
But it wouldn't be here without him. Thanks for listening.
Hallo, hier ist wieder Clark. Wusstest du, dass 61% der Deutschen bereit wären, Geld für eine Versicherung der Erde auszugeben? Bis das möglich ist, kannst du deine Welt im Kleinen versichern. Die passenden Angebote findet der Clark-Algorithmus aus über 160 Versicherern für dich. Natürlich zugeschnitten auf deine aktuelle Lebenssituation. Und bei Fragen stehen dir die Clark-Versicherungsexperten zur Verfügung. Teste uns. Jetzt anmelden und deine Versicherungen einfach über die kostenlose App managen. Ohne Papierkram. Wenn du dich jetzt mit dem Gutscheincode PODCAST30 alles großgeschrieben registrierst und deine Versicherungen in Clark hochlädst, erhältst du einen Amazon-Gutschein von bis zu 30 €.